This episode is brought to you by Bin to Table, a monthly food subscription service for folks who want to cook with the best pantry ingredients on the planet. Learn more at bintotable.com and use the code HRN at checkout to get $20 off your first month.
This week on Meat and Three, we're spotlighting the people who prepare our meat before it reaches our plates. We hear from whole animal butchers, the brains behind a meat vending machine, California cattle ranchers, and a master of charcuterie who isn't using meat at all.
It's like a smoked and grilled center stalk of the broccoli, and then it gets finished with some mustard, barbecue sauce, and sauerkraut.
Ranching and farming being as difficult as it is, you know, it's just one thing after another. And at some point, you just give up.
I had a wild idea that if I learned butchery, maybe I could start to be kind of a link in the supply chain.
Listen to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Delia Villadere. We'll talk to Delia about building and running a winery in Napa, women in wine, and a lot more. We'll taste the 2017 Villadere Black Label Red Blend for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Delia Villadere, born in Argentina, made education a priority. She spent her formative years in Europe, bringing her PhD from the Sorbonne to the U.S. to further pursue business and wine studies at MIT, University of California, Berkeley, and Davis. Delia got into the wine business in the early 80s and was one of the first women winemakers in the Napa Valley. She is now the president and CEO of the now multi-generational Villadere Vineyards and Winery on Howell Mountain. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Delia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, due to COVID-19, we're doing a remote broadcast via Zencastr, which is a remote platform. You are at the winery in Napa Valley?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So, Delia, I want you to give everyone a little background, a little context of who you are and how you got here. You traveled the world to get to Napa, pretty much. Can you give us a brief background on your journey in life and wine that got you currently to your own winery, Villadere Vineyards and Winery?
Well, I traveled the world literally all my life.
Okay.
Not only for the wine business. My father was in the diplomatic corp, so we would move a lot.
Okay.
And that already prepared me. The advantages of that is that I speak six languages, all of them with an accent, but I do fluently speak six languages. So
wait, when you say you speak six languages, I assume one of them is French.
One of them is French.
Spanish, and you say you
Italian,
have an accent.
German.
What's the accent on a French?
My accent on the French is somebody that speaks fluent Spanish. So they think I'm from Toulouse.
Okay. I was just curious about that. All right. So six languages. Go ahead.
And actually, it's helpful because it allows me to read philosophy, which is my passion, before wine in the original language. So it's,
now you got your doctorate in philosophy, right?
Correct. I had a doctorate in philosophy from Sorbonne, and I transferred to the United States as a PhD via UC Berkeley.
Delia, that's pretty heady stuff, philosophy. All right, continue.
It's pretty heavy stuff, but it's actually a way of being, a way of thinking. My concentration was on logic, so you use logic usually every day?
Yes, I think so.
Some people may not, but most people do. So it is helpful for business and is helpful for what I set out to do in the States. I came as a student.
Right.
So really, I didn't really know anything about winemaking or wine growing. It was an opportunity that actually was presented to my father, and I came with the idea that perhaps this was the break I was looking for. I was recently divorced and I had all the kids with me. And wow. I thought,
what are we talking, the early 80s?
Very early 80s, yes.
Okay.
1984, actually.
Okay.
And I presented a plan, a business plan, to my dad. I didn't know much about wine growing, but what I don't know, I can always hire a consultant for. That I always knew. So I set out to call consultants, actually, from all over the world. I studied and requested help from a lot of friends. I had a lot of friends in France that own wineries for several generations, and I have some friends in New Zealand that actually came and help out, because the place where I started is a very steep, rocky mountain, and very steep is a 32-degree slope. It's the same as the streets of San Francisco.
Wow.
And pretty much when you're going up, let's say, Taylor Street towards California,
right,
you see the lines for the tram. It's exactly 4 feet apart, which is the distance between vine rows.
Really?
So
that's interesting.
You get your stairmaster right in the vineyard every day.
Can you back up for a second? Your dad owned the land, or he purchased the land that you're talking about?
He gave me the seed money to purchase the land.
Okay, what was that moment, or when was that decision that you decide, you know, with all the traveling, all the education, all the exposure from the family, that the direction was going to be wine? I mean, what was that?
My father was always very succinct and very correct in presenting things. He, after hearing what I had come up with, he says, after all the money I poured into your education, all you want to become is a farmer?
Oh, boy.
He had to pay for all my degrees.
The guilt trip, right?
Totally.
Oh, boy.
But I, as a dad, hear me out. I think this will be an ideal place to raise a family, and the ideal situation, because I'll have them with me 24/7, and they will be close to nature, in an ideal place. And
so that was the vision. The vision was, if you do that, you could be with your family as a single mom. You're kind of one with nature, great place to raise the kids. Then how does it morph into the wine thing, which requires money, planning, and work?
That was, the place was in Howell Mountain. It was offered to my father as a possibility for a house, for a residence.
Ah.
And I thought, all the valleys planting to grapes, and they're beginning. It was a time that the industry wasn't that fashionable, let's
right.
put it that way.
Or prevalent.
Or prevalent. It was really small number of wineries. And but we all had heard about Bob Mondavi, so it was integral in all the decisions, the help that he provided. He had an open door policy in which anybody that wanted to know or participate in any of their trials could come in.
So it was a community in that sense.
It was definitely a community, and he was always welcoming, especially young entrepreneurs like me that wanted to start. So you wanted to start in the wine business. And what are you planning to do? Oh, good girl. And how are you going to do that?
Well, you bring something up, and you know, this is a question I had a little later on, but we can talk about it now. I mean, talk to me about being a woman in business, being a woman in the wine business, which, you know, you just described in its infancy, and in the early 80s, you know, which is certainly, you know, a different time than now. I mean, we've come a long way, but it sounds like, you know, at least Mondavi opened his arms. What about everything else? You know, working with banks, farmers, consultants, and all that. Tell me what it was like being a woman, you know, back then when there were very few.
Well, perhaps my advantage was that I wasn't born here, so I didn't find out that there supposedly is a glass ceiling somewhere.
Right.
I never saw it. I never even imagined it. So that was an advantage,
sure.
Perhaps, of not having been born here.
So you sort of didn't give a crap. It's like, I don't know how you do it. Here's how I do it, right?
Right. And it's just by temperament. I will work hard and I will put all my intuition and all my everything, all of me into it. And I'll give it my best and I'll figure it out.
But along the way with all of that, was being a woman a disadvantage for you to grow and advance the business?
Perhaps if I would have thought differently, but to me, it's always been to my benefit. I was very young.
Right.
I had an accent. I had lots of kids that were with me all the time.
Can't yell at a woman with kids, right?
And if you can think about it, it was. People didn't know where to put me. Where my classification? What was appropriate? But I was kind of. I've always been a happy person. I've always been very optimistic, and
so that
I've
projected.
And I think it projected because usually people open up and we're extremely helpful. And
so
for
Let me sort this out for a second. So a guy back in those days who just looked at women, you know, totally different, he was so perplexed by you because of the way you presented yourself. Is it fair to say that?
Yes.
Like he couldn't take you down. He couldn't push you around. He didn't understand you. So he just, you know, went along. Is that fair?
Yes. I just went along. And
good strategy.
Well, remember.
It's really who you were.
It's really who I am, and my emphasis has always been in logic. I'm very logical, so
right. You think, therefore, you are.
I actually compose myself and what I say and how I present things in a way that I will get the answer I'm looking for.
Right, you trained yourself. I mean, you were. In those times, you were a very interesting person, let alone woman. Do you, when you look back, I mean, I'm sure we could do a whole show on this, but, you know, tell me some of the differences of Napa in the 80s, you know, versus now. I mean, what are the things that come to you first, good or bad?
Well, it was a much smaller community, and it was really much more of a community.
Right.
And because I was kind of in exile in a way, I kind of fell in or fit in more with what we used to call the French Mafia at that time. And,
Which, tell me what that was.
Most of the winemakers that, or the families that established themselves in Napa and that were coming from France.
Really?
Most of the people from Domaine Chandon and most of the people, the previous owners of La Dera that were the previous
right.
owners of La Mission.
And they were there then.
They were there then.
Yes.
And then
so you found a comradeship with them.
connection with Claude Duval because Bernard Porté, French, married to a Chilean, Elia. And and then Valeria and Augustine Sr., he knows. At that time, they didn't even have Quintessa, but they had Franciscan. So it was right. a number of people, and then my very, very close friend, now called Della Valle. And
right.
it, you know, we had, and of course, in Mondavi, at that time it was at Opus One, Geneviève Janssens.
Sure. She's been on the show.
Yes. So we, our kids were kind of the same age, very right. close. So we grew up celebrating the French traditions for Christmas, and the kids grew up more in a European background
right.
and type of consideration with respect to alcohol consumption. And I am going to get in trouble.
No, you're not.
Well,
by who?
Well, I used to tell my kids when they were little, what we do at home stays at home, and please don't tell anybody that you can actually taste wine at home because mommy is going to be put in jail.
Well, I guess legally you had to be careful, but I mean, in Italy and in France, I mean, that's the culture, but different laws. But trust me, the Mondavis were doing the same thing.
Exactly. So, and my biggest mentor was Margaret. So definitely we got so, very, very close.
So the differences were smaller community. You hooked in with a certain group. Now, obviously, it's much bigger. You know, maybe the community is broken into different communities or even dissolved. And it's definitely more diverse, right?
Yes, it's more diverse, which is wonderful, but there is also less in terms of communication, and this was before COVID also, in terms of people living here. I came and established first my residence, and then I built the winery.
Right.
So it was different.
Yeah.
In that sense, most of the owners and winemakers lived around or very close to the wineries, and we would connect one-on-one very often.
Right. Well, you know, talking about diversity, and I want to pick your brain on this. You know, Napa's not famous for being one of the more diverse wine communities. You know, in light of the pandemic, which we talked about, and, you know, there's just been months and months of protests, and that's been fired up even today with the Breonna Taylor thing. I mean, can Napa Valley, the people of Napa Valley, can they do anything to create more inclusion or diversity or equality in your... Tell me how you're doing it and how you can get other people and what they're doing.
We're very community oriented. I'm part of a association, is the Napa Valley Vintners,
right?
And we definitely were here to protect and enhance the Napa Valley and promote. That's also we're a marketing organization, but also protect and promote and. There is a lot that we do for the community, not only for the health, the housing of our workers, the health, and specifically the education. I think education is the key to everything and to create opportunities for that diversity. Having said that, remember, Napa is in California. It really reflects demographically what the state of California is all about.
Which is
close to a third Hispanic. So the Napa Valley, the Napa County is probably very much in proportion to the state of California. We have a lot of Hispanic people. So... it's not the same, not to say that we don't welcome people of any other diverse groups, in lieu of the protests, we've been trying to look at something that will perhaps as a token or as an opportunity, the Napa Valley Vendors decided to grant a scholarship and pay for it every year up to $1 million to United Negro College Foundation, which has been given scholarships and opportunities to people of color. But because we are in California, and of course we would like people to be taken care of in the wine business in Napa Valley, 40% of those scholarships from the United Negro Foundation were given to Hispanics.
Right. So just because of the reflection of the population.
Because of a reflection of the population. Right. It's not because there isn't a welcoming mat. As a matter of fact, slowly and surely, people get attracted to the wine business. It's from one way or another, through the restaurant business or through the sommelier business. Or
right.
Through, you know, people get attracted. It's happening.
Well, stay on that note, because, you know, I've been to a bunch of the Napa wine auctions, and, you know, they raise literally millions, and that goes back to health and education
98%.
Services, you know, which I know you're intimately involved. But here's where I want to take this, because I think you talked about, you know, how the industry, you know, is involved with the community. When you look specifically at your business, which is wineries, wine hospitality, wine making, all of that, do you see enough women in important positions? Do you see enough black people in it, Latino, even indigenous? Do you feel that it's where it should be?
I wouldn't be the one to decide where it should be. But I definitely see that we've done a lot of advances, given opportunities. I actually put my money where my heart is. And from the get-go, being an immigrant, I totally understood and fluent in Spanish helps.
Right. Sure.
I proposed to all of my workers that they needed to learn English, and I didn't obligate them. I proposed it because I had a plan that if they were willing to take the sacrifice or make the sacrifice to go to the high school at night after work, I would pay them for taking English lessons.
And right, it would be another skill or tool in their toolbox.
It would totally be another skill, because if they understood English, I could send them to the local junior college to get computer skills. They
right.
could learn how to do other things. And surely it was a voluntary and also on an honor system. They will present to me how many hours they attended and their certificates for English proficiency and this and that and the other. And I would pay them extra to complete that. And the ones that wanted to continue, they would continue going to the junior college. And they would go on to further themselves and become more skilled and attain a better job.
Yeah, that's a great incentive and offering on your part.
It's the incentive.
You need to understand
what
it takes to offer it, and, you know, you did.
And you need to understand what every parent wants. Every parent wants the best for their kids. So
think like a parent on this one.
Think like a parent on this one.
Good
so what I offered was scholarships to their kids. Instead of a bonus, I would give them a scholarship. The if their kids maintained a 4.0 grade average, I would pay for their education. They could choose where they wanted to go.
Wow.
And many took that opportunity. And I have graduated a couple already from med school, from business school. And that's, for me, the power of education. Give them a chance. They'll take it. They'll work hard. And then you'll see it blooming.
Well, that it sounds like, you know, a great thing, and certainly keep that going. I want to talk to you about your winery and your wines, but first I want to understand something about you, because I think I was on your mailing list 20 years ago. I mean, I'm very familiar with the wines, cut my teeth in Napa, you know, so this is sort of easy and old school for me. But what I don't know about you is you're sort of this red wine obsessed person, you know, with a love for Cab Sauv and Cab Franc and every other Cab Franc and every other Bordeaux blending grape, I think, except for Merlot. Tell me how this... Is this an Argentinian thing? Is this the land dictated that? You know, you're a red winemaker, basically.
I am very much a red wine snob in a way, because I it's very difficult to grab my attention with white wine. It's not that I don't like it. I do like certain type of white wines, but I prefer.
What, like Montrachet? What do you like in white, quickly?
Yes, Burgundy.
Okay.
It's a personal choice, you know.
Oh, sure. Like, all right. So tell me. So continue on. I interrupted. Didn't mean to. The grasping of red and the love for it.
It is really something I like. I said I didn't know much about it, but I grew up in. Also, in kind of a European household,
right.
both my parents were European, so it was, in a way, I had pretty much my palate kind of decided, and only needed to learn how to express it. That's the part. It's something, it's very easy to me to communicate to people that they say, oh, I don't know anything about wine. I don't know anything. And I said, well, can you sing? And it's like, yes, I can sing. Well, it's the same with wine. You don't need to be Pavarotti to know how to enjoy wine. You like it or you don't like it. And you come with everything. You come equipped with everything that is needed. You don't need to know more. And it was a question of, once I started tasting and particularly blending, playing with the blends, that's what really got me. And made me really passionate about the discovery. The new, every year is a new beginning, is a new blend, a new possibility, a new set of coordinates.
You have to back up for a second, because yes, Napa Valley is, you know, really known for Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, blending that. You took Cabernet Franc and even Petit Verdot, you know, to the forefront of your winery. Those were personal choices. You liked, you know, how they blended. You liked their characteristics. You know, you listen, when you look at every winery, they don't, you know, offer wines with the type of blends and blending that you do. How did you get to that?
It's personal choice and personal craziness. But remember that my palate was international.
Right. So the five Bordeaux blending grapes.
The five Bordeaux blending grapes. The only reason I cannot grow Merlot in Napa Valley is because it's a very finicky, difficult grape to grow on a hillside that is so rocky. But I grew Merlot in Tuscany when I had the vineyard in Tuscany for about 8 years. I was next door to Ornellaia, so I did grow Merlot.
Right. I mean, Masetto is a great,
yes,
a great Merlot-based wine.
Petrus, great Merlot. Yes.
All those guys. Before we take a break, and however long it takes, I want you to just give me a little primer, a little primer on Howell Mountain, because your vineyard is located on Howell Mountain. So just take, you know, a little time to tell me about the soils you're working with. You talked a little about the terrain and it's hilly, but get into that a little more. The climate. We talked about the grapes. You know, we can go back on that. Just tell me, because there's a lot of AVAs, obviously, in Napa, and even within the AVAs, there's a lot of microclimes. Tell me what you're, you know, dealing with on Howell Mountain.
Well, we are technically not in the AVA because, as it happens, the AVA was created before the vineyard was planted. So we were not asked to participate.
I'm glad you cleared that up.
But nonetheless, the AVA starts at 1,400 feet and we are 1,300 feet. So a stone throw from the AVA.
So right there, tell me what altitude does to wine.
Definitely helps.
And
the whole vineyard layout, it was especially designed and calculated to bring the best of nature to your advantage. We calculated the direction of the wind. We calculated which way the sun sets and how it will project. We planted vines going up and down the hill with no terracing at a time.
Now, the up and down is versus going across, right?
Exactly.
So okay.
Normally, they would have planted a vineyard this steep contour. And because it is so steep, you would have left banks completely exposed to erosion. We planted with the wheel.
Now, what about soils? I mean, what was left on the mountain soil-wise? What are you planting in?
What am I planting in is
rocky.
It's sheer rock. Red
it
rock.
Is
very red. Very high in iron content. Volcanic, of course.
Uh-huh.
Most of it is of volcanic origin. Although there's, you know, it's California. It's been moving around in a few thousands of years. So we have, because I put the winery underground.
Right.
We were able to really see the composition of the soil. It's mostly a very hard rock, rhyolite, and in between is volcanic tufa, which is a little bit the kind that breaks in your hands.
Right.
And in between all of that, we have basalt, which is not, it's found much, much deeper. So that came up throughout the millennia when, you know, California is dancing.
Right.
As we always do, about 400 times a year.
Right. What does that mean? The roots struggle because
yes, it's not.
It sounds dry and it's not, you know, loamy, soily, sandy. So
no,
what does that create? Does that create a mountain small berry?
Creates a mountain small berry, and for that, I created a very small vine. It's actually closer to the ground. It's a combination of what you would find in Bordeaux, closer spacing, and what you would find in Burgundy, closer to the ground.
Right, because of your circumstance.
Because of the circumstances, what we were trying to do is get the canopy, protect the clusters of grapes at the peak hours, noon hours. The way the canopy shades protects
right.
the the clusters.
So your canopy management plays to the way the vines are set up.
Are set up.
To inhibit growth, protect all of that.
Exactly. And the clusters are hanging much closer to the rocky soil. That's one of the reasons why most of the guys have to pick on their knees. You cannot stand up. You just go low. It's very low. That's why I said it's Burgundy, more Burgundian.
Right. I know the answer to this, but I want you to tell everyone, because of where you are and because of the soils and how you plant, you have a smaller berry. Mm-hmm. You know, what are the characteristics of your grapes, you know, versus, you know, a bench grape, say in Rutherford or something?
Well, the vines actually translate what they find in the soil. And here they have much more iron in the soil and much more minerals in the soil. So you will find Powell Mountain, because of the exposure and the extreme characteristics of the mountain, right, will have much more concentration and much more towards a plum or a cassis black fruit.
Intensity and a dark black fruit, for sure.
Yes, that's typical of this area.
Now, on the climate front, are you dealing with more wind? You're obviously dealing with more sun. You know, what else? I mean, cool at night, hot during the, you know, what is the climate fairly predictable and consistent generally, or no?
Well, we are farmers, so we deal with things we cannot control or predict. The weather has been changing, and it has been turning. What we are afraid most is the heat spikes during the season. And heat spikes mean exactly that. When the heat goes, like yesterday, we were in the 80s at the noon hours. At night, we go down to 50.
Wow.
And this weekend, we're going to go on a heat spike again to 100 degrees at the noon hours. So those
this coming weekend?
Yes, this coming weekend.
Wow. Late September. So that's, you can't deny climate change there.
You can't deny that climate it's
changing.
It is something is happening, because the extremes are getting to be a little bit more pronounced.
Right. Delia, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Delia Villadere from her own winery, Villadere. Delia, when we come back, I want to talk to you specifically about your wines, you know, some of your practices, what you're doing out in the field and in the cellar, and a few other things. So you are listening to The Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and we'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Bin to Table, a monthly food subscription service for folks who want to cook with the best pantry ingredients on the planet, founded by Ben Simon. After working for President Obama, Ben spent 5 years traveling the world for Greenpeace, campaigning on climate change and sustainable agriculture. He always kept his eye out for delicious food to bring back home. Now, with everyone's travels on hold and home cooking more important than ever, Bin subscriptions provide a way for home cooks to experience different food cultures each month and put together nourishing, delicious meals with the best pantry items on the planet. With Taste the World, get a new shipment of different best-in-class ingredients to explore a new cuisine each month, along with tips and tricks to help out. We're talking delicious, single-origin spices, cold-pressed olive oil, beautiful sauces, and lots of ways to use them. There's also an essential subscription which gets you a delicious assortment of heirloom, hard-to-find recipe staples. You can also get both each month with the full Bin-to-Table box subscription. Learn more at bin-to-table.com and use the code HRN at checkout to get $20 off your first month, and Bin-to-Table will donate $10 to HRN.
We're back. We're back with my guest, Delia Villader. Delia is the proprietor of her own winery, Villader. She's been in the Napa Valley since the 80s. And Delia, along with her son, Alan, make wines. We'll talk about the wines in a minute, Delia. But talk to me about vineyard practices. You know, I see you are Napa Green certified for winery and land. Tell me what that is and what you had to do to get there.
It's definitely by nature. I live here. I lived here all my life. All my kids grew up here. And my house, my window is directly across the vines. So there has always been a very front and center this holistic approach about keeping and making sure that there is no pesticides, there is no anything negative that you will cause harm to the environment or to other people. I wanted to rest assured that the dogs could just run around and my kids and grandkids can run around and go and near harvest, start eating grapes, particularly near harvest when they're so sweet.
Just pick them and eat them without worrying about it.
Pick them and eat them, and there is no worries that, you know, other than too many grapes.
Right. So is it fair to say that this sounds like it resembles organics?
Yes, we were certified organic for okay. the first 11 years.
So you're then practicing that in the field.
Definitely, from the very get-go, because it was important to us. I was raising my kids, and I definitely did not want to harm them in any way, in any
now, there's
possible
a,
way.
There's a next thing to that, and, you know, because you are there and you raise your family and you plan to be there, you want the soils to be alive the way you want your kids to be alive and grow. Do you think about regenerative farming? I mean, are you forced to that? How do you?
We tried. Yes, we tried. Also, for another 10 years, we tried biodynamics, and it is. We adopted Napa Green because it allows us to do organic, biodynamic, and sustainable organic. So
right.
we adapted a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Whatever was successful of every one of the programs that we were part of wasn't 100% sustainable in our particular situation. For example, when we were fully biodynamic, it was great for the soil, but the younger vines were dying. It is extremely time consuming, and the vines, when they're growing up, it's like a child growing up. You need the nutrients, otherwise
right.
you're not going to grow strong and fruitful. And the timing for biodynamics worked for the soil, but it didn't work fast enough to give the nutrients to the plants at the time that they were actually needing them.
Right.
And I didn't want to use synthesized, so any other chemical. So we had to kind of adapt the organic and the biodynamic in the Napa Green program. It allowed us to do a little bit of everything with a holistic approach in keeping, you know, the use of any kind of chemical
right.
To the minimum. And to that, my son took it even to the next extreme, because he has, now that the tech wave has also invaded the the industry. He has sensors and sensors of sensors a little bit everywhere, right in the palm of his hand. So he knows exactly how much and or how very little does he need to irrigate, or does he need to do a spraying of some sort. He doesn't want to overdo in right. water or in product to the vine. So it's very precise. All of a sudden it became very, very precise and adapted to our circumstances. It's since we do not have any clay whatsoever, it's mostly rock and almost sandy loam.
Right.
There is need for irrigation at a specific time in the cycle of the growing vine, but we have perfected the timing to right. give absolutely the bare minimum.
It's funny you say that, because when we were talking earlier, when you took over the property, you basically had to rely on instinct and nature when you walked the property on how to plant, where to plant, what to plant. You know, now everything is so data driven. It's crazy. And, you know, God bless Alan for taking advantage of that. But, you know, the reality is he ain't doing bad, and you didn't do bad either without it. So, you know, you take everything you work with. Tell me about cellar practices. You know, obviously you take an approach out in the fields where you don't want any chemicals. Please tell me you don't go into the cellar and schmutz up all the wines. You
absolutely
know.
Not. We're kind of non-interventionist and try to. We took the whole year to create this beauty of a fruit. We don't want to mess it up in the cellar,
right.
definitely.
Farmers first.
Farmers first. And that's where the wine is made. In the cellar, all we're trying to do is just shine the light at the best of that season.
So Alan is you know, making the wine. What do you and him have a different style or approach? You know, has that been a fight? Has it become obvious, you know, to the drinker? Just give me a quick take on that.
I don't think it has become obvious because we solved very logically. I created Viadera as a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc with a high proportion of Cabernet Franc, but also with the idea of a classic Bordeaux
right.
blend. And when he came on board and he was promoted to full-time winemaker, he had been helping me since he was 6 or 7 years old.
Right, so he knew everything.
he knew more or less how mom works.
Right.
He was promoted. So we came to an understanding that he had free range to create his own blend. And that's how Viadera Black Label came about.
Now, I have a Black Label in front of me. In a few minutes, you know, we're going to drink that. I actually just opened it to let it breathe. So instead of letting him screw around with your stuff, you let him make his own stuff.
Right, because he
Good
needs
idea.
To have his own voice. He needs to be able to put his own artistry and express it. I don't want him to do what I do. Yeah. I don't want him to copy.
Delia, you're a good mommy. You let your kids get their own space. Let's talk about the wines. You know, there's a handful of wines. We kind of mentioned them, but let's sort of tick off the list. The sort of flagship legacy wine is the Viadera, the one that you made. And that is Cab Sauv and Cab Franc. What kind of percentages through the years of Cab Franc? And it's only those two grapes?
Is only those two grapes, only the two caps, and with as much, in some vintages, as much as 45-49% of Cabernet Franc.
Wow. All right, and then the next wine is, I guess
the
we
one
could say the Black Label?
The Black Label, yes.
All right, that's kind of an interesting blend. Tell me about that Alan's creation, right?
It is Alan's creation, and he threw everything at it except the kitchen sink. he put Cabernet and Syrah, and I said, okay, that's an interesting blend. It's not a Bordeaux blend.
No.
And
but it's been done, and it's being done.
And it's being done. And then he said, no, but I'm not happy with the blend. I need to add some more. And he did his internships as when he was going to college in Argentina, and he fell in love with Malbec. I did not have planted Malbec at the very
so
beginning.
Alan was instrumental in planting Malbec vines?
He brought, yeah.
Okay.
Brought Malbec from Argentina. So we had 174 vines at the very, very beginning. It took about 14 years to have a reasonable crop to be able to use it. And he added it to his wine, of course.
Okay.
The black
and along with Cab Franc, of course. You wouldn't let him leave the house unless he put some Cab Franc.
Well, we both love Cab Franc. It's very special. We have a clone that is finds itself very much at home in this hillside, and it produces
great.
A very intense and a very dense Cabernet Franc.
But so jump to your Cab Franc wine. You make a Cab Franc wine called Dare.
Yes, this is a kind of our second label, and we dare to make a single varietal Cabernet Franc when people were not yet kind of seduced by Cabernet Franc.
There was only a handful of guys in the valley, right? Like Larkin and the other guy, I forgot, that were making Cab Francs. True?
Very few would even consider Cab Franc other than as a blender.
Right, so that's the dare. And then, of course, you couldn't settle on that. So you made a predominant Petit Verdot called V.
That was when really the wine bug got me. That's a blend that I created in 98.
Wow, it's been around.
Very challenging. Yeah, very challenging year. And, it's very interesting because I served as a bridge between French winemakers and Napa Valley winemakers for a long time. And I used to tease them a lot that about the Petit Verdot that actually we mature it in the vineyard and we would get it to full maturity. So I decided to use it as the main component of the blend, and I added Cabernet Sauvignon just to make it drinkable.
Very nice. And then the final wine is sort of an homage wine, and the name refers to that. What is it, Homenaje?
Homenaje, yes. That's something that Alan wanted to do as a tribute. Homenaje means tribute.
Right.
And at our 30th year of production, he finally came up with a couple of barrels of something really special that he felt it will be a tribute to his grandfather. The one that put the seed money.
The guy who got everything going.
Got everything going, and that was actually the main figure in his life. My father was here every other month with my mom. They would visit, and these were their only grandchildren for the longest time. My brothers didn't have children until much later. All right.
So I want everyone to know that, you know, we've been talking about these wines, and these are, you know, limited production. This is a premium, you know, line of wines. You know, these are very fruit-driven wines, which are a good reflection of Napa. You know, so I hope people go out and take an interest in these, buy them, Google them, and all of that. But just understand, you know, we're talking, you know, about a premium wine, and you know, I think Delia explained, you know, what it takes to get there. Delia, we have less than 10 minutes left, and there are two things that I really want to do. The last thing is to taste the black label and talk about it and evaluate it. But before that, I do a thing called the wine list, and I ask all my guests 5 questions. Everyone gets asked the same 5 questions. Don't dwell on them. People are interested in, you know, what you're drinking. I post these on our social media sites. So we're going to go right to the first question. The first question is, what is Delia Villador drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you tasting? What's on the table? Give me a couple of wines.
What's on the table? For lunch, we opened a 2012 Villador, and just to try it. And we always do that.
Because so you're always tasting your wines. Go ahead.
We're always tasting our wine, and specifically because I sold out of that wine. So I find it in the website and I buy it.
Wow.
And I buy it back so we can taste our babies.
There you go. So you're tasting older vintages of your wine. Anything else?
Older vintages of the wines every day. And we share with everybody. So everybody can have a little bit of an opinion and they can dissect. It's very interesting when they try to pitch my son's style versus my style, and they can't, because in the end, it's Villador. We make the wine from the place, and we try.
Right. The place is always going to be what it is.
It's winning. The place.
All right. We got
it.
Next question. Your favorite wine and food pairing. Is there anything from a kid, as an adult, something you love, not something you necessarily eat every night, every week, every month, but what's the great Delia Villador wine pairing?
Oh, we do very often this Colorado lamb chops, the little lollipops.
Those
are so perfect in the grill. With any red wine, actually.
Okay. So a good grilled, you know, baby lollipop lamb chop with a good, you know, full broth, you know, whether it's the Villador proprietary,
the black label. Yep. It will go great with the black label that you have.
All right. Tell me your favorite wine restaurants or bar. I guess, you know, the best way to answer that, and you don't have to leave anybody out or you're not favoring anyone, but tell me any wine restaurants or bars in the area that have a great selection, have a great vibe, have a good wine knowledge, or welcoming. You know, because people like to hear from you. If I'm in Napa, you know, Delia says, I mean, can you name anything?
Other than the usual, I hope that they do come back. We have a few normal places, hangouts here in the valley.
Tell me a couple.
We go to a simple one. R&D Kitchen, for example.
Okay.
Or even
that's a good one.
Farmstead in St. Helena has a good farm to table.
Yes.
And they also have very nice wines. They happen to be very food oriented.
Those are the type of places I was hoping you would say. Those are good answers. Go no further. All right. Tell me favorite all-time wine. I tell all my guests when I initially put this question on the list, I was trying to prompt you to tell me the rarest, most expensive wine you ever drank. That's not really the question anymore.
Yeah.
Tell me a wine that is so important to you. It changed the way you thought about wine. It was the first time you had something. It influenced how you made. What's an important wine to you?
Well, it's an important wine, something that has a certain personality that comes through. And it has happened with, yes, many important wines like Cheval Blanc. Of course, it always elates me to find the Cabernet Franc aging so well.
Right. So when you answer that, Cabernet Franc plays into, I totally get that. I should have thought that. So like a Cheval Blanc or
Cheval Blanc.
Yep.
I love that density, but that floral note, that delicacy. It's a certain ethereal elegance that a wine can have, because that's what I try to infuse in my wines. They're in perfect harmony. I don't want to make the wine the main attribute of a meal. It's just background music.
So I hope one of the results of this show is that we've excited and got people curious about Cab Franc and wines that have Cab Franc. And that's definitely expressed through your favorite wine. Last question, and this may be hard from you, but I'm going to make you work because you make premium wines. But if you had to recommend to my kids in their 20s or some of your kids, cheap wines, if you had to recommend wines for them to go out and buy for 15, 20 bucks because they don't want to bring crappy supermarket wines to a party or a dinner or as a gift and they're not spending $40, recommend a red and a white. You could go category like Muscadet or Chenin or whatever. What I'm challenging you, what comes to your mind for really value-driven red and whites?
An excellent value-driven. Does it have to be U.S.? Because
No. Anything. Yeah. Just keep close to the price.
Clos de Lucieta, definitely, as a red.
Okay, good
Malbec,
one.
It's a Malbec from Argentina that actually Michel Roland.
That's exactly what I'm looking for. Usually the red is harder. You got that out of the way. But you're not a big white drinker. So what would you say for a white?
Not a big white drinker. And Clos de Lucieta is probably around $25 at the most.
Perfect.
And a white, I'm not a white drinker, so I usually will drink Sauvignon Blanc.
Okay, that's always a good value as a category, so I'm going to take that. All right, we're running out of time, but I want to do this. Every week we taste a different wine on air. For our weekly wine sip this week, Delia was nice enough to send me a bottle of the 2017 Viader Black Label. That's Allen's blended wine. Quickly tell me a little about this wine.
We just got it out of the bottling line.
Really?
So I hope it's our newest release, but it hasn't been released yet. So I hope you enjoy it. And like I said, it will go perfect with
so this
lamb.
Is
lollipop.
That was my last question, but this is Cab Sauv Malbec Petit Verdot.
Yeah, it's Cab Sauv Syrah.
Syrah.
And then a pinch of Malbec and a pinch of Cab Franc just to hold it all together.
Okay. Yeah, because I don't get a ton of, I have it in front of me. So the color, obviously, with all those grapes is a dark brooding wine.
Yes, that's why it's black.
The nose, do you get any one of the grapes characteristics on the nose more than the other? You know, what would you describe the nose on this as?
No, you don't, because it is not your typical Cabernet, and it doesn't have the kind of earthy or bacony of the Syrah.
No, as a matter of fact,
it's totally very Cabernet, but with the Malbec, it softens. It's like the pinch of salt that holds everything together.
Right. And the mouthfeel it's a very, you know, full-bodied, mouth-filling wine. You would expect that from those grapes. Tell me on the palate, you know, what are some of your palate descriptors on this? Obviously, dark fruits?
Obviously, dark fruit, but what Allen intends, and maybe because he's a guy, he gives you a little bit more punch in the palate. He raises the acidity a little bit. So it's really a very umami type of wine. It really fills your palate. Not heavy.
It's not heavy. And the acidity makes it good with food.
Exactly.
And you said the perfect pairing would be to go back to those Colorado lollipops.
Something grilled. Throw something in the grill, even grilled vegetables. It has the acidity to go through and with harmoniously.
When will this
anything.
Be available in the market?
Probably at the end of October. So
we're close to that. I just drank a half a glass of it, and it is delicious. It is not, you know, too heavy. I think Napa sometimes, you know, gets caught up. It was a generation of, you know, over-extracted, fruity, jammy wines. You know, this has the balance, you know, of all of that. I like
it
that.
It has to have it to last. Has to have harmony. It has to be something that is pleasurable, that you enjoy, you don't have to pay attention to. You don't have to kind of,
I like it.
too much thinking about it. It's just more intuitive.
I like it. Delia, we got to wrap up. I told you the hour would go quick. I could probably stay on with you for another hour. There's a bunch of things I didn't even get to. We could have talked about the wine more, but maybe that'll leave us for another time. Let me do a quick wrap up, and I want to get some info from you. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. You could always use the hashtag The Grape Nation on both of those. As I mentioned, we will post Delia's wine list answers on our social media sites. I will also post a little more information on the 2017 Black Label that we just tasted. Delia, if we want to get more information on your wines and you, where do we go on the internet, on social media?
Viader.com.
That's Viader.com. We'll bring you to the site. A lot of background. You can order wines and all that. And I think the Instagram site is Viader_Napa.
Yes.
So if you want to follow the winery on, are you on Facebook?
I think so. That's all Alan. It's his generation.
You know what? I'll look it up and I'll post it. All right.
It's his generation. Is that mine?
Oh, stop with this his generation stuff. All right. We got to go. Thank you to our guests, Delia Viader. Thank you to our engineer, Amanda, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Benrubi, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.